Welcome to the Big Mike Fun Podcast, where you learn about advanced wealth building strategies from real estate investing to creating massive ROI and secure retirement profits. So pour yourself a cup of coffee, grab a notepad, and lean in. Because Big Mike has got the mic, starting now.
Welcome to the Big Mike Fun Podcast. I'm the Big Mike.
Mike Zlatnik, and today it is my pleasure and a privilege to welcome Jack Martin. Hey, Jack.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate being on your show.
Thanks for coming on the show. Let me give you a formal quick intro. So you are a co-founder of 5210, 5210 Partners with qualified investors to acquire and reposition mobile parks. So you're all about mobile park. Recession-resistant strategy mitigates risks of loss and provides stable cash flow through any market cycle. Let's see, you've been through a lot and you've done what, $450 million of real estate and $55 million across multiple funds, direct investment. So welcome to the show.
Well, I'm glad to be here, Mike. Let's talk all things mobile home parks.
Yeah. So we're recording this in December, 2025. What's the scoop right now with mobile parks? What is happening? One thing that I've known about mobile parks, I've heard this is, again, I'm not an expert, no supply. In other words, they're not building anymore. It's very limited product. Cities don't like them. They don't want to permit land to be turned into mobile parks. So essentially, you know, the supply is, well, it is what it is. I guess you can improve a mobile park. You can invest money. You can do some value at work, but you can't get any new product. You can't get new ground up construction. There's no ground up construction. There's no land allowed for it, right? Let's just talk about the basics.
Yeah, so there's limited new parks that are developed in the United States of America. Generally, there's about 10 new sizable mobile home parks that come online each year across the United States of America.
10. That's the whole gamut, right?
And most of those are in Texas. When I say sizable, there may be some, you know, small private mobile home parks that are built that are not tracked. But when I say sizable, I mean of institutional quality. So it's going to be over 100 lots. You know, it's something that's would be considered class A in the apartment space. That's large enough for an institution to have some interest. There's only about 10 of those built per year. Comparatively, there are, like, I live in next, and there's 10 to 15 parks per year that are knocked over for redevelopment into another asset class.
So they're taking supply down. They're taking mobile home parks and turning them into something else.
That's correct. Yeah, and on top of that,
supply shrinkage, not growth.
Correct. Yeah. So the supply of mobile home parks is shrinking. And then if you look at available product to acquire, the consolidation of this asset class from the original owners, which were mom and pops or families that handed them down through generations, groups like ours, we call ourselves a professional park owner, will go buy those from those mom and pops and we'll solve whatever inefficiencies exist there. There's the value add play. And then typically groups like ours are, when they're finished repositioning those, they sell those to the institutional owners. So once the institutions own them.
But it has to be a certain size, I assume. Institutional owners don't want really small size. There's got to be a certain number of minimal number of lots, right? I assume.
Yeah, or a portfolio. Like I've seen institutions buy parks as small as 50 lots. If it was part of a portfolio. So if they can get a large footprint in one market, they might buy 7 properties. 2 of them are large and then the other 5 are a little bit smaller.
But in the same market. So at least they have management, you know, management is not too difficult if it's too far away from each other.
Yeah, that's right. So I think the message there, to kind of circle back on your initial statement, is that the supply is shrinking both from redevelopment and from acquisition by institutional owners. Once those guys buy them, they never come back to the market. And then of course, there's not very much being built. So the replacement is much slower than the shrinking asset class.
So you're seeing as a result, healthy rent growth in most markets. Is that what's happening? And what kind of rent growth are you seeing organically without value add? Just like, what's the inflation?
Yeah, so typically in the mobile home park world, let's say your rents were at market, they're going to increase at about 5% per year. That's pretty standard historically. That's still current today. So unlike the volatility that you see in apartments, for example, if there's so much new supply, we're actually seeing in the Phoenix market, seeing apartment rents come down.
Yeah, the rent growth for sure. Phoenix has been in a negative territory for a bit.
That's
for a while, actually.
Yeah, so that's not the case in the mobile home park business. You know, we're a little bit more conservative than others. So our objective is not to raise rent to market in the first 12 months that we own it. We'd like to kind of slowly take smaller bites out of that and give the residents a less steep path to catching up to the market. But I've seen operators buy parks and raise rent 50% just to get it back to where the market is. So there's operators that do it.
So, but that requires, I guess, some investment. I mean, unless it's a really mom and pop park where the rents are so low that you acquire it at a ridiculous, ridiculous discount to the rents, and of course discount price because the rents are so low. And then the market, I assume, it's just supply. It's a supply driven. What about demand side? Is demand increasing? People continue to. And when we're talking about mobile home parks, we are not talking about RV parks. We're talking about homes that are sitting on a property for a long time. They're still considered to be mobile home parks, but it's not a motor coach that you brought in. You park there for some amount of time and then you move on. So just differentiate the two.
Yeah. So for your audience, an RV park is considered rolling stock. So the stock of housing that exists in that property can roll in and roll out on a daily basis, weekly basis. You know,
that's an RV. Those are just
the park. Yeah. So a mobile home park, even though mobile homes are in the name, mobile is used. They come in on wheels, but once they're set, they're permanent. They rarely ever move. And we've been in this business for over a decade, and across almost 2,000 lots, you know, we may have one or two mobile homes that move each year. So it just doesn't make any economic sense to move them. It's a single wide will cost, you know, $7,000 to $10,000 to move, and a double wide could cost as much as $20,000 to move it. So once they're set and they're in place, it's considered permanent housing. The only difference is the homeowner doesn't own the land.
So yeah. It's bolted on. They're connected to all the plumbing, all the electric, and they just bolt it on. And it's a land lease for them for that lot to be able to have their home.
Correct.
Just curious, what cap rate are you typically, you know, buy these at? On the as is basis, if you look for a target, is there a good cap rate that is healthy, or it's a difficult story because you know if you have a lot of value add, then the current cap rate may not be as relevant as your potential.
Yeah, it's probably not the metric that you would evaluate an investment by, but cap rate will be relative, and let's call it a stabilized cap rate, and assume that we purchased a property, we did all the capital improvements, we filled all the vacant spaces, we raised the rent to market, we've stabilized expenses, and now we're ready to sell it. Cap rates will range anywhere from high threes, low fours in a really attractive, expensive market to somewhere in the 8-9% range in more rural tertiary locations. So that's a stabilized asset. But yes, Mike, speak to if there's a heavy value add, let's say that there's a lot of vacant lots that can still be you can perform infill and gain more income, you might buy a attractive investment in the low threes.
Well, it's less relevant because you have a lot of vacancy, right? You have a lot of vacancy. So I do like the stabilize, of course, that's your target cap rate in a given market. And then how much of a discount are you getting and how much work premium?
That's right.
Will you get for, you know, improving the property, leasing up empty spaces? So on the demand side, are you seeing growth in demand? Again, I'm just trying to understand from the point of view that you have a lot of supply of multifamily housing, and as markets got oversupply of multifamily, substitution effect, you know, people may choose to live in a mobile home park or they can go rent traditional apartments. They're not directly competing, but just like you mentioned, a lot of new supply in multifamily and, you know, choosing to stay at the mobile home park is a matter of, you know, you either used to a property like this or, you know, you can't afford apartments and you go to mobile home parks. Like those are less expensive in general. That's my perception, unless I'm wrong.
Yeah. So first of all, to answer your question, we own parks all across the United States. So not just in the Arizona or Phoenix market. And demand, there's some nuance to the demand in every market, even within an individual state. Like we have more demand in central Arizona than we see in southern Arizona, for example. But that would be the same for any asset class. If you're renting VRBOs or apartment units, like that demand nuance is still going to be present there. But generally, the cost on a monthly basis to live in a mobile home park is about 50% of that of a equally appointed apartment in the same neighborhood.
For the same, I don't know what the square footage of a mobile home park or mobile home would be versus an apartment. Is it similar to or a little bit smaller?
It depends. I mean, we have homes as large, and we have 5-bedroom, 3-bath homes in some of our parks. Those are double wide, 1,800 to 2,400 square foot homes. But the average mobile home is probably going to be more like, 1,100 to 1,200 square foot for
an apartment,
3-bedroom. And then it goes up from there.
But the cost is so much lower because insurance, lower taxes. I mean, there's still utilities, like energy is energy. Maybe it's less expensive.
Yeah, speaking to the lot rent. So this assumes that you own your home. The lot rent in most markets is going to be at less than half of what the apartment rent is for a 2-bedroom apartment. So like in Phoenix, for example, in a working class neighborhood where 2-bedroom apartment rents are somewhere in the 1800 range, you would see mobile home park lot rent be somewhere in the 900 or less range.
But then there's a cost of the mobile home.
Correct. Yeah, correct. So then this separates the difference between a renter and a homeowner. So some people want the flexibility of renting because if something changes in their life, they can pick up really easily and move on. That's the other side of that coin is for the landlord, that's disruptive because now they have turnover, right? In the mobile home park business, a resident that you attract wants to be a homeowner. They want certainty with respect to where they live. Kids go to the same schools, all those kind of things. And they want to gain equity. So even though it's a mobile home, it still has value. If they decide to exit, they sell it, the value of the home has some correlative relationship with the value of the housing market in the neighborhood.
Are they mortgageable? In other words, if you're trying to buy one, can you get a mortgage on a mobile home?
Yeah, typically the amortization schedule is shorter. So where if you buy a single family home, you get a 30-year amortized loan. In the mobile home park business, it's usually 15 to 20 years.
Because they think of it as not exactly a home. They think of it as, I guess, sort of like a car.
It is. Yeah, the financing is very similar to getting an auto loan. So the lenders view that as the useful life is going to be shorter than a site-built home. So the willingness to lend is a shorter period of time. But with that said, I mean, we have homes in some of our parks that were built in the 50s and 60s.
And they're still hanging in there.
Yeah.
Fascinating. So let's go into the investment part of this whole business. As you buy these investments, and again, I don't know what's a classic investment looks like. Give me an example of a deal recently did, acquired something at what cap rate, what's the value at plan, what purchase price, and then what kind of cash flows, what kind of we project what kind of growth. Just walk me through a typical deal that you sort of did recently. Anything that comes to mind?
Yeah, we'll just grab the last park that we acquired, which was in Omaha, Nebraska. 138 lots. It was right central downtown, close to the freeway, or close enough to the freeway where we have income that comes from a billboard on the property that you could see from the freeway. Only one park owned home. So that's the manager unit. Everything else was owned by the tenants.
38 units, all tenant owned.
All
so
tenant
you bought
owned.
The land and all the leases,
Correct. Correct. Yeah. So
is it fully occupied or this got vacant?
That one was. That's a rare occasion that it's fully occupied, but that's just how that one showed up. usually there's a handful of vacant lots and there's some component of park owned homes, whether they're rentals or they're vacant. Typically we'll assume some of those, but this particular one did not have that. This one on a 7-year hold period, conservatively probably a mid 14 IRR, a little more than half of that will
come. That's IRR deal level or LP level?
LP level. Yeah, LP level.
So your deal level IRR you're projecting to be what range?
You know, I don't recall what that one was, but it's in the 20s, mid-20s, probably somewhere in there. So the splits for us is typically going to be 75-25 on average in favor of the LP. But that one had a coupon to the LPs out of the gate. Year one was somewhere in the mid to upper threes. And then at the end of the 7-year hold period, it was closer to 10. The cash on cash.
Because of a lot of what kind of value add can you do to push the yield up that much, that fast? Year three, you said, right? Year three, yes. You'd be.
So the combination in all of our parks is going to include lowering expenses. So they're higher than they should be. A lot of times that's because mom and pop are running them. They have, or there's an absentee owner that's running it and then he has way more staff on site than they need. Or they're not maximizing the use of their maintenance staff, so they're using outside vendors, and those can get really expensive. And on the income side, rents are lower than the market. This one I think wasn't that bad. It was probably somewhere in the range of mid 20s, 20% below the market. So it wasn't dramatically below the market. But then there was the vacant office building that, you know, we can get a lot of income. We'll take those office buildings on a fully occupied property, doesn't need a manager's office anymore. And we'll split that up into some executive suites and we'll lease those out to the market. And then there was billboard there, an older billboard on an older contract where there's substantially more income potential there than what they were getting. And then there was some vacant land that had not yet been developed that we can develop into additional lots. So there will be some infill that we'll add there as well.
So it's a multi-pronged strategy to add value to get to these IRR targets through, interestingly enough, cost-cutting, auxiliary revenue, right? And I guess you look for every area of opportunity, new lots, empty buildings, and you know, rent growth. It's actually, you know, just listening, it's an operating business, really. It's not, you know, it's not a pure real estate because a lot of the things you mentioned is you're improving, yeah, I mean, some real estate improvement, but there's a lot of like, you know, renegotiate billboard contract. Mm-hmm. It's semi-operating, right? And cost cutting is definitely an operating thing, big time. Billboard, you could say it's a one-time value-add activity, but with the cost cutting, you're running the business way more efficiently with less staff and less expenses, which is, I hear this a lot of times, but it's I'm not questioning what you're saying. I'm just saying quite often, I've heard this rodeo many times. Everybody's planning to make some improvements, introduce new technology. I was at a business dinner last night and one of the folks there saying that they, you know, they use technology so much that they reduce staffing, you know, more than 50%, different asset class. And when I hear this, like, that's wonderful if you can do that. Maybe that's the truth. Maybe AI and tech comes in and you don't need a staff member on property at all, or you know, maybe one person on a sizable property instead of having two or three people. So is that what you're seeing? Is that how you're thinking through advanced technology, both for leasing, for maintenance requests, for, you know, payments, everything else?
Yeah, so we'll use technology to the degree that it can. And I think that every year it gets better. But I don't see 50% reduction in staff requirements. I don't see that in this asset class. So there's mobile home park management is a little bit more heavy hands-on than other asset classes. For example, if you go to the park owners in the United States, they all have vertically integrated internal property management in-house. None of them use an outsourced, a third party. Or very rarely is
that. For mobile home parks, there's no, it's not like property, not like apartments where you have a lot of property managers.
That's right. So in any major market, you get 100 choices of property managers for apartments, where in the mobile home park business, you might have three or four in a major market. And the challenge is that there's too many moving parts. You have home sales. You're moving homes in and out. The amount of heavy lifting that's required to take an underperforming property to a stabilized status is a lot of work. And if you're a manufactured housing community, third-party property manager, you're only collecting on a percentage of the lot rent, which is $500 to $600 on average across the United States. So there's just not a lot of revenue there. So what we found, and we did try third party initially 10 years ago, what we found is they can collect the rent, they can hire and fire staff, they can pay your bills and provide you reporting. That's about it. That's all they can afford to provide. So if you want to take advantage of the real upside in the manufactured housing community space or mobile home parks, you need to be able to do all that stuff in-house.
Yeah, understood. And that's why you need, I guess, sizable properties or multiple properties in the same area. Otherwise, you know, how do you get people to be in that area? They had to live somewhere and they have to, you know, they have families too. So your staff needs to be, I mean, I see this with apartments too, where there's some shared resources between apartments owned by the same parent or the same, you know, property management company in the apartments, but they share resources. Mm-hmm. Properties that are not far from each other. I guess it's the same approach here.
You either have to have a large footprint initially with a single property, or once you have that one, you can bolt on, other properties around it, and it gives you economy of a scale.
Yeah, understood. And using this deal for the return perspective, just trying to assess. So mid-teens IRR, cash flow starts kind of light, but then it picks up. Is this typical and common? And you run, I guess you said 75-25 split, you run a pref, you run asset management fees.
Yeah, so those splits, depending on the check size, they can get more favorable or less favorable for the LPs, at least with 5210. Typically, this pref hurdle is going to be somewhere around 7, and there's going to be an acquisition fee, a 1% asset management fee, and then a disposition fee or a refinance fee. So we keep the fees pretty light. I think that the thing that deserves to be talked about here, I mean, through the lens of an LP, that what's the most attractive things about a mobile home park investment, assuming that you have a good sponsor that's, you know, behind the investment and doing all the work?
Let me guess what's the most attractive thing on that. Okay. I'm going to guess, and if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But I know a little bit about this, so it's not that I'm inventing the wheel on the fly. It's the bonus depreciation. I think it's going to have massive, because these things depreciate better than apartments.
Yeah, that's probably the second. If I was interviewing a typical $1 million check writer, that would be his second most favorite thing.
What's the number one?
The stability. The likelihood of preservation of capital is number one.
Why do you say that?
Well, I mean, when you're evaluating an investment, I think this is what I hear from our LPs. The first thing that attracted them to mobile home parks was the stability. If you look at economic events like the GFC, you go try to find a mobile home park that went to foreclosure in 2008 through 2012 of size. You won't find one. They just don't go to foreclosure. They're super stable. Go try to find evidence of a mobile home park that didn't collect their lot rent through the COVID pandemic. Those are in extreme conditions where mobile home parks really shine. They're extremely stable.
So during COVID, if I understand you correctly, tenants paid rent not the same way the apartment complex tenants paid rent, where they especially Class C properties have a lot of collection issues. I'm just curious if the mobile home parks didn't hit a collection issue during COVID.
Yeah. So what few people recognize, and this is the reason behind why we collected 100% of our lot rent. In the apartment world, if you're exercising your right to strategically default on your rent because of the moratorium on evictions during the pandemic, the recourse that the property owner had was at the end, when the moratorium is lifted, they can evict you and take your deposit. That was all the recourse they had. In the mobile home park business, if you don't come current on your rent, not only do I evict you, you have to forfeit your home.
Oh, as part of the contract, they're actually putting the home at risk if they own the home?
Yeah, so this is the law. in mobile home parks that if you don't pay, you can't come current on your rent and you get evicted, you have to leave your home there and it becomes the park owner's property.
So it's really, you're acting like a tax authority, essentially, for non-payment. I don't know if you're leaning the asset or not, but it's just, you know, you're not letting them off the property, you're holding to there. It's interesting. It's just that.
Yeah, so it doesn't, the mechanics aren't necessarily that way. The way that the regulatory or the regulations is written is it's kind of like if you abandon your, you parked your car in a parking lot, it accrued parking expenses, and then at some point it becomes an abandoned car and it becomes the owner of the parking lot or the owner, it becomes the property of the parking lot. It works a little bit more like that. But tenants that live in mobile home parks understand that. So yeah, there was people that were seeking strategic default. They came into our offices and said, I heard we don't have to pay the rent. And then the manager said, well, that's true. You don't have to. But when the moratorium is lifted, you have to come current or you get evicted and you lose your home. So they pay the rent.
Yeah. I understand that angle. That's actually a good point that you have better collections as a result. You know, it's similar. We do triple net industrial, right? I mean, tenants pay. It's a different experience for businesses. You know, who are there for a long time, they're not going to default their business. Here, you have a significant collateral in the form of the mobile home that's sitting there. So they're not defaulting on something they don't own, and they can just go, you know, pick up their stuff and don't pay the rent for however long and move. Yeah. Right. So it makes sense. It's actually, in my head, it's comparing the similarity, and I feel, yeah, I mean, I can understand that there's more protection mechanisms here versus in apartments.
Yeah, and then if you kind of add on top of that, I mean, there is still tenant turnover because tenants move across the country or whatever. But when they decide,
how much turnover do you actually see per year? Like you have, you know, 138 lots. How many of these things turn?
It's going to be less than 5%. On average, it's probably between 1% and 3%. So these are homeowners.
It's very sticky.
Very sticky. But when
average apartment complex is just multifamily, you could have 30-40% turnover, which is normal. And here you are only doing 5%. It's just great.
Yeah, it's really sticky. And then when they leave, they sell their home. That's the mechanism through which they move. So it's too expensive to move their home. Even if it's within the same city, it would cost more money to move it than it would be just to sell it and go buy another one in a different property.
So, you don't even have turnover. You have just a different person living in the thing. So I thought physically 5% pick up their you know, trailer or whatever, the mobile home, and they move. But it's not, like you said, it's too expensive.
Yeah, the transfer of ownership, like your resident base may turn over between, you know, 1% and 5%. But the homes still the same homes. So
yeah, that's fascinating. Now yes. I begin to understand why, like, this is stickier and this is more, you know, if you got a good, well-occupied property that you're running well, these homes are not going to move. Maybe some few people will move, but the homes are not going to move.
Correct.
As a result, you got a steady type of a setup.
That's the, in, like, the underlying thesis of mobile home parks is the stability. So back to that conversation about LPs, their first answer is, I love this because of the stability. The likelihood of me losing the coupon that I signed up for, but certainly B, losing any portion of my principal is extremely low. So that's what attracts them initially.
Yeah. It's a very defensive investment. Appreciate you clarifying. I am just comparing in my head to industrial because, I mean, we do triple net industrial and the similarities, stability, predictability. I mean, that's the key. You're not shooting for super high IRRs, but you're not, I mean, it's a safety of principal first and then some kind of adequate rate of return in general.
Yeah, and then back to your comment about bonus depreciation, that's the thing that gets them the most excited. And bonus depreciation will be anywhere from 100% coverage. I mean, you could get as much as 200% coverage, but, you know, conservatively, it's probably more like 150% coverage for every dollar that you invest. So you get a lot of losses on your K-1.
Yeah, I'm aware. I mean, we've seen, in, like you said, 150% coverage in, you know, it all depends on the leverage. What kind of leverage do you get, by the way, in a mobile home park? On a debt, like you're buying a mobile home park, you're financing with bank debt. What is a typical leverage?
Yeah. So typically we'll buy parks that qualify for agency debt. So either Freddie or Fannie. Today, you could probably get 70% leverage as long as you meet a 125 DCR. So like a lot of times the loan sizing will be smaller than 70% because the cash flow on the property is not yet meeting that 125 DCR.
Yeah, I was going to say exactly that because you're buying initial cap rate. It's too damn low to meet the DSCR, right. Even though you can meet the LTV, but you can't quite... It's kind of interesting. We've looked over the years into mobile home parks. We've not found any interesting investments. At least cash flow initially is too light, and it's exactly the reason because they traded a low cap rates. Unless you're really in the boonies, right? And that's a different conversation. But it's an interesting asset class. But on the 70% leverage, you could easily run over. The purchase price, first year bonus depreciation is typically how much? Essentially, you buy something for $10 million, an example. Mm-hmm. What's your first year bonus?
So in that case, there probably is $7 million. So if you get 70% leverage and you put $3.5 million down, let's call it, you know, $500,000 for some CapEx or something, you're going to get 180% coverage or somewhere in that range.
Yeah, I can see this. Multifamily is at 30%, you are at 60-70. So you're doing double multifamily because I guess you're depreciating. I mean, the entire thing is there's no allocation for any long schedule. Almost the entire, everything is really, maybe not 100%, and you still have some land, but everything else, you're bonus depreciating.
Yes, so typically we'll get about 70% of the property's value as land improvements. And that's where you take the bonus, that's 15 years. So that's where the bonus depreciation is really powerful. Then most of these properties are going to have, you know, 10 to 20% is the land value. And then if there's some kind of office building or something like that, that would be the remainder.
Understood. I mean, this is great. Appreciate you, your wisdom. What's the best way for folks to reach out to you? Is there a website? Any other way?
Yep. Yeah. Go to our website, 5210.com. That's the number 5210.com. And just go to the contact page.
That's great. Any final comments, thoughts, any book suggestions, something just...
Mike, this has nothing to do with mobile home parks, but I think the best book that has ever been written on the real estate cycles in America is called The Secret Life of Real Estate and Banking. And it's written by a gentleman named Philip J. Anderson. And it's a 200-year history of the cycles, the cyclical nature of real estate. And it kind of weaves in the corruption from banks and government entities and lobbyists and all that kind of stuff. And then the natural greed of humans. So fascinating.
Yeah, there's so much to say on that. The pendulum swings both ways and sometimes swings too much. You know, we've seen a cycle recently and we're probably going to see many more in the future. Mm-hmm. But it creates opportunities. So every time you go through a cycle, it creates buying opportunities. And those people who don't miss the cycle, you know, they take it on the chin. And that's life.
That is.
And the government, unfortunately, I'll just add one comment. I've talked about this so many times. They've given us cocaine many years called ZERP, right? Zero interest rate policy. They got a lot of people addicted to it. And then they withdrew the cocaine very fast. And then you had a withdrawal syndrome and caused massive grief. And whether you like it or not, the Fed often wrong, often late. And, you know, it's been the case. Even now, I'll just add one quick comment. I'm reading the book 1929, Andrew Ross Sorkin, just kind of coming to light of these, you know, booms and busts. There's a little bit of a concern of AI boom and maybe overvaluations and how, you know, you go 1929. Example of the government being sound asleep, the Fed not really paying attention. Now, of course, tolerance for pain is much lower. Then they just let problems happen. They didn't mm-hmm. think of this the same way they think now. Now they cut rates, they flood liquidity. It's how they solve problems. But the same behavior. It's kind of like these patterns repeat and again and again and again. So I appreciate you sharing. That was one more time. What was the book?
It's called The Secret Life of Real Estate and Banking by Philip J. Anderson. He's actually an Australian guy. but he studies real estate market cycles worldwide, and that book specifically written about America.
That's wonderful. Thank you for sharing. Thank you for coming on our podcast.
Thank you for inviting me, Mike.
Thank you for listening to the Big Mike Fund Podcast. To receive your copy of Mike's How to Choose a Smart Real Estate Fund book, head to BigMikeFund.com or visit Amazon and type Mike Zlotnick. Keep listening and keep investing Big Mike style. See you on the next episode.